the main reason we haven't yet ruled out dolphins and whales as moralists of the deep is that they are so hard to study in the wild. Most of the evidence about the chimpanzees, some of it self-censored by researchers for years, is that they are true denizens of Hobbes' state of nature, much more nasty and brutish than many would like to believe. 4. Sociobiology, good and bad, good and evil. The human brain works however it works. Wishing for it to work in some way as a shortcut to justifying some ethical principle undermines both the science and the ethics. For what happens to the principle if the scientific facts turn out to go the other way? Steven Pinker, 1994, page 427. Sociobiology has two faces. One looks toward the social behavior of non-human animals. The eyes are carefully focused, the lips pursed judiciously. Utterances are made only with caution. The other face is almost hidden behind a megaphone. With great excitement, pronouncements about human nature blare forth. Philip Kitcher, 1985b, page 435. Another part of our inquiry into human nature as a naturalistic basis for sound ethical thinking would begin with the undisputable fact that we human beings are products of evolution, and consider what limitations we are born with and what variations there are among us that might have ethical relevance. Many people apparently think that ethics is in deep trouble if it turns out that human beings aren't, as the Bible tells us, just a little below the angels. If we are not all perfectly rational and equally rational and perfectly and equally malleable by education, and equally capable in all other regards, then our underlying assumptions of equality and perfectibility are jeopardized. If that were true, it would be too late to save ourselves, for we already know too much about human frailties and human differences to sustain that vision. But there are more reasonable visions that are also jeopardized by the discoveries of scientists, not just evolutionists. There is no doubt that the sorts of facts we can learn about an individual or a type or group of individuals, women, people of Asian descent, etc., can profoundly affect how we tend to regard them and treat them. If I learn that Sam is schizophrenic, or profoundly retarded, or suffers from dizziness and periodic blackouts, I am not going to hire Sam to drive the school bus. When we turn from specific facts about individuals to generalizations about groups of individuals, the situation is more complicated. What is the reasonable and just response of insurance companies to the actuarial facts about the different life expectancies of men and women? Is it fair to adjust their premiums accordingly? Or should we treat both genders alike in the premium department and accept their differential rate of receiving benefits as fair? With regard to voluntarily acquired differences, smokers versus non-smokers, for instance, we see fairness in making the smokers pay for their habit in higher premiums. But what about differences people are just born with? African Americans are, as a group, usually prone to high blood pressure. Diabetes runs higher than average among Hispanics. And whites are more prone to skin cancer and cystic fibrosis. Diamond, 1991. Should these differences be reflected in calculating their health insurance? People whose parents smoked in the home while they were growing up run a higher risk of respiratory disorders through no fault of their own. Young men, as a group, are less safe drivers than young women. Which of these facts should count for how much and why? Even when we deal with facts about particular individuals rather than statistical trends, there are quandaries aplenty. Are employers or others entitled to know whether you have ever been married, have a criminal record, a safe driving record, a history of scuba diving? Is there a principled difference between releasing information on a person's grades in school and releasing information about that same person's IQ score? These are all difficult ethical problems. The citizenry is currently debating various restrictions on what information employers, the government, the schools, the insurance companies, and so forth may seek regarding individuals. And it is a short step to the conclusion that we'd all be better off if certain sorts of information were just not pursued by science at all. If there are big differences between the brains of men and women, or there is a gene that predisposes for dyslexia, or violence, or musical genius, or homosexuality, it might be better for us to be kept in the dark about such things. One should not dismiss this suggestion lightly. If you have ever asked yourself whether there are facts about yourself, about your health, your competence, your prospects, you would rather not know, and decided that there were, you should be prepared to consider seriously the suggestion that the best, perhaps the only way to ensure that such facts are not imposed on people, is by prohibiting investigations likely to discover them. On the other hand, if we don't investigate these issues, we forego important opportunities. Society has a strong interest in keeping track of the drunk driving arrests of potential school bus drivers and making them known to the appropriate decision makers. And it has the same strong interest in discovering any other facts about its members that may enhance our lives or protect society at large or particular members of it. This is what makes the research decisions we reach so critical and so likely to generate controversy. It is not surprising that sociobiological research is conducted in an atmosphere of unremitting concern mounting to alarm. And when it escalates, as it often does, the propaganda sometimes buries the truth. Let's begin with the term sociobiology. When E.O. Wilson coined it, he meant it to cover the whole spectrum of biological investigations concerned with the evolution of interrelations between organisms in pairs, groups, herds, colonies, nations. Sociobiologists study the relations among termites in a mound, cuckoo hatchlings and their duped adoptive parents, the members of matriarchal groups of elephants, bands of monkeys, elephant seal bulls and their harems, and human couples, families, tribes, and nations. But, as Kitcher says, the sociobiology of non-human animals has always been conducted with greater care and caution. See also Ruse, 1985. In fact, it includes some of the most important and widely heralded advances in recent theoretical biology, such as the classic papers of Hamilton, Trivers, and Maynard Smith. Hamilton could be said to have inaugurated the field with his introduction of the conceptual framework of kin selection, which solved, among other things, many of Darwin's puzzles about eusociality in insects, the way ants, bees, and termites live selflessly in large colonies, most of them sterile servants to a single fertile queen. But Hamilton's theory didn't solve all the problems, and among Richard Alexander's important contributions was his characterization of the conditions under which eusocial mammals might evolve, a prediction stunningly confirmed by the subsequent studies of the amazing South African naked mole rats, Sherman, Jarvis, and Alexander, 1991. This was such an astonishing triumph of adaptationist reasoning that it deserves to be more widely known. As Carl Sigmund describes it, Hamilton's ideas led to a most remarkable discovery when, in 1976, the American biologist R.D. Alexander lectured on sterile castes. It was well known that these existed for ants, bees, and termites, but not for any kind of vertebrate. Alexander, in a kind of thought experiment, toyed with the notion of a mammal able to evolve a sterile caste. It would, like the termites, need an expandable nest allowing for ample food supply and providing shelter from predators. For reasons of size, an underbark location, like that of the presumed insect ancestors of termites, was no good. But underground burrows, replete with large tubers, would fit the bill perfectly. The climate should be tropical. The soil, more than a hint of Sherlock Holmes here, heavy clay. An ingenious exercise in armchair ecology altogether. But after his lecture, Alexander was told that his hypothetical beast did indeed live in Africa. It was the naked mole rat, a small rodent studied by Jennifer Jarvis. Sigmund, 1993, page 117. Naked mole rats are surpassingly ugly and strange. A thought experiment of Mother Nature's to rival any of the fantasies of philosophy. They are genuinely eusocial. The single queen mole rat is the sole female breeder, and she keeps the rest of the colony in line by releasing pheromones that suppress the maturation of the other female's reproductive organs. Naked mole rats are caprophagous. They regularly eat their own feces. And when the grotesquely swollen pregnant queen cannot reach her own anus, she begs feces from her attendants. Had enough? But there's much, much more. Highly recommended to all whose curiosity exceeds their squeamishness. A bounty has been learned from the study of naked mole rats and other non-human species, using the techniques of Darwinian reverse engineering, using adaptationism, in other words, and there is surely more to come. E.O. Wilson's own important work on social insects, 1971, is deservedly world famous, and there are literally hundreds of other fine animal sociobiologists. See, for example, the classic anthologies, Clutton Brock and Harvey, 1978, Barlow and Silverberg, 1980, King's College Sociobiology Group, 1982. Unfortunately, they all work under a cloud of suspicion, raised by the escalation of greedy claims by a few human sociobiologists through their megaphones, as Kitcher suggests, which is then echoed by the escalation of blanket condemnations from their opponents. This really is an unfortunate fallout, for, as in any other legitimate area of science, some of this work is great, some is good but false, and some is bad. But none of it is evil. That serious students of mating systems, courtship displays, territoriality, and the like in non-human species should be tarred with the same brush as the more flagrant oversteppers in human sociobiology is both a miscarriage of justice and a serious misrepresentation of science. But neither side has done its duty. Unfortunately, the siege mentality has made the best of the sociobiologists somewhat reluctant to criticize the shoddy work of some of their colleagues. Though Maynard Smith, Williams, Hamilton, and Dawkins can often be found in print firmly setting aright various innocent flaws in arguments and pointing out complications, in short, making the corrections that are the normal topics of communication in all science, they have largely eschewed the deeply unpleasant task of pointing out more egregious sins in the work of those who enthusiastically misuse their own good work. Donald Simons, 1992, is a bracing exception, however, and there are others. I will point to just one major source of bad thinking that is ubiquitous in human sociobiology and is seldom carefully addressed by sociobiologists themselves. Perhaps because Stephen Jay Gould has made the point in criticism, and they would hate to concede that he is right about anything. He is right about this point, and so is Philip Kitcher, 1985b, who develops the criticism in much more detail. Here is Gould's version, which is a little hard to understand. At first, I didn't see how to read it sympathetically, and had to ask Ronald Amundsen, an excellent philosopher of biology, to explain to me what Gould was getting at. He succeeded. The standard foundation of Darwinian just-so stories does not apply to humans. That foundation is the implication. If adaptive, then genetic, for the inference of adaptation is usually the only basis of a genetic story, and Darwinism is a theory of genetic change and variation in population. Gould, 1980 C, page 259. What does this mean? Gould is not saying, as he may seem at first to be saying, that adaptationist inference does not apply to humans. He is saying that since, in the case of humans, and only humans, there is always another possible source of the adaptation in question, namely culture, one cannot so readily infer that there has been genetic evolution for the trait in question. Even in the case of non-human animals, the inference from adaptation to genetic basis is risky when the adaptation in question is not an anatomical feature, but a behavioral pattern, which is an obviously good trick. For then there is another possible explanation: the general non-stupidity of the species. As we have seen so often, the more obvious the move, the less secure the inference that it has to have been copied from predecessors, specifically carried by the genes. Many years ago, I played my first computer video game at the AI lab at MIT. It was called Maze War, and more than one person could play it at once, each at a separate terminal linked to a central time-sharing computer. On the screen, you saw a simple perspective line drawing of a maze, in which you, the viewer, were situated. Corridors could be seen up ahead leading off to left and right, and by pressing keys on the keyboard, you could move forward and back or turn 90 degrees to the left or the right. Another key on the keyboard was the trigger of your gun, which fired straight ahead. All the other players were in the same virtual maze, wandering around, looking for someone to shoot, and hoping not to be shot. If one of the other players crossed your path, he would show up as a simple cartoon figure, whom you would hope to shoot before it turned, saw you, and shot you. After a few minutes of frantic play, in which I was shot from behind several times, I found my mounting paranoia so uncomfortable that I sought relief. I found a cul-de-sac in the maze, backed myself into it, and just sat there, relatively calmly, with my finger on the trigger. It struck me then that I had adopted the policy of a moray eel, patiently waiting in its well-protected hole for something strike-worthy to swim by. Now, does my behavior on this occasion give us any reason to suppose there is a genetic predisposition to moray eel behavior in Homo sapiens? Did the stress of the occasion dredge up some ancient policy lying dormant in my genes since the days when my ancestors were still fish? Of course not. The strategy is just too obvious. It felt like a forced move, but it was at least a good trick. We would not be surprised to find Martians backing themselves self-protectively into Martian caves, and the likelihood that Martians had mores for ancestors would presumably not be adjusted upwards from zero by the discovery. It is true that I am distantly related to moray eels, but the fact that I found this strategy in this environment is surely just a matter of its obvious excellence, given my needs and desires and my own assessment of my limitations at the time. This illustrates the fundamental obstacle, not insuperable, but much larger than is commonly acknowledged, to inference in human sociobiology, showing that a particular type of human behavior is ubiquitous or nearly ubiquitous in widely separated human cultures goes no way at all towards showing that there is a genetic predisposition for that particular behavior. So far as I know, in every culture known to anthropologists, the hunters throw their spears pointy end first. But this obviously doesn't establish that there is a pointy end first gene that approaches fixation in our species. Non-human species can exhibit a similar, if reduced, capacity to reinvent the wheel, even though they lack culture. Octopuses are remarkably intelligent, and although they show no signs of cultural transmission, they are smart enough so that we should not be surprised to discover them individually hitting upon lots of good tricks that had never been posed as specific problems to their ancestors. Any such uniformity might be misread by biologists as signs of a special instinct, when in fact it was just their general intelligence that led them again and again to hit upon the same bright idea. The problem of interpretation for Homo sapiens is multiplied many times over by the fact of cultural transmission. Even if some individual hunters are not bright enough to figure out for themselves that they should throw the pointy end first, they will be told to do so by their peers, or will just notice their practice and will appreciate the results immediately. In other words, if you are not totally idiotic, you don't need a genetic basis for any adaptation that you will pick up from your friends in any case. It is hard to believe that sociobiologists can make the mistake of ignoring this omnipresent possibility. But the evidence is striking that they have done so again and again. Kitcher, 1985. Many instances could be listed, but I will concentrate on a particularly visible and well-known case. Although E.O. Wilson, 1978, page 35, states clearly that the human behaviors to be accounted for by specific genetic hypotheses should be the least rational of the human repertoire, in other words, they should implicate innate biological phenomena that are the least susceptible to mimicry by culture, he goes on, pages 107 and the pages directly after, to claim, for instance, that the evidence of territoriality in all human cultures, we human beings like to call a bit of space our own, is clear proof that we, like very many other species, have a genetic predisposition wired in at birth for the defense of territory. That may be true. In fact, it would not be at all surprising, since many species manifestly do exhibit innate territoriality. And it is hard to think of what force there might be to remove such a disposition from our genetic makeup. But the ubiquity of territoriality in human societies is, by itself, no evidence at all for this, since territoriality makes so much sense in so many human arrangements. It is, if not a forced move, close to it. The very considerations that in other parts of the biosphere count for an explanation, in terms of natural selection of an adaptation, manifest utility, obvious value, undeniable reasonableness of design, count against the need for any such explanation in the case of human behavior. If a trick is that good, then it will be routinely discovered by every culture, without need of either genetic descent or cultural transmission of the particulars. We noted in Chapter 12 that it is the prospect of convergent cultural evolution, reinventing the wheel, that plays havoc with our attempts to turn memetics into a science. The same difficulty besets all attempts to infer genetic factors from cultural commonalities, and for the same reason. But although Wilson has sometimes noted this problem, at other times he forgets. The similarities between the early civilizations of Egypt, Mesopotamia, India, China, Mexico, and Central and South America in these major features are remarkably close. They cannot be explained away as the product of chance or cultural cross-fertilization. Wilson, 1978, page 89. We need to look at each remarkable similarity in turn to see if any of them needs a genetic explanation. For, in addition to cultural cross-fertilization, cultural descent, and chance, there is the possibility of reinvention. There may be specific genetic factors operating in many or all these similarities. But as Darwin stressed, the best evidence will always be idiosyncrasies, quirky homologies, and no longer rational survivals. The most compelling cases of this sort are currently being uncovered in the marriage of sociobiology and cognitive psychology, recently going by the name of evolutionary psychology. Barco, Cosmides, and Tooby, 1992. Highlighting a single case will provide a useful contrast between good and bad uses of Darwinian thinking in the study of human nature, and clarify the position on rationality, or just non-stupidity, just presented. How logical are we human beings? In some regards, very logical, it seems, and in others, embarrassingly weak. In 1969, the psychologist Peter Wason devised a simple test that bright people, college students, for instance, do rather badly on. You may try it yourself. Here are four cards, some letter side up and some number side up. Each card has a numeral on one side and a letter on the other. D, F, 3, 7. Your task is to see whether in this case the following rule has any exceptions. If a card has D on one side, it has a 3 on the other side. Now, which cards do you need to turn over in order to discover if this is true? Sad to say, fewer than half of students in most such experiments get the right answer. Did you? The correct answer is much more obvious if we shift the content, but not the structure, of the problem very slightly. You are the bouncer in a bar, and your job depends on not letting any underage, under 21, customers drink beer. The cards have information about age on one side and what the patron is drinking on the other. Which cards do you need to turn over? One is drinking beer. Another is drinking Coke. The third is 25 years old. The fourth is 16 years old. The first and the last, obviously, the same as in the first problem. Why is one setting so much easier than the other? Perhaps you may think it is the abstractness of the first, the concreteness of the second, or the familiarity of the second, or the fact that the second involves a conventional rule, not a regularity of nature. Literally, hundreds of Wason card sorting tests have been administered to subjects, in hundreds of variations, testing these and other hypotheses. The performance of subjects on the tests varies widely, depending on the details of the particular test and its circumstances. But a survey of the results leaves no doubt at all that there are settings that are hard for almost all groups of subjects, and others that are easy for the same subjects. But a riddle remained, reminiscent of the riddle of the two black boxes. What exactly was it about the hard cases that made them hard? Or a better question, what was it about the easy cases that made them easy? Cosmides and Tooby? For example, Barco, Cosmides and Tooby, 1992, Chapter 2, came up with an evolutionary hypothesis, and it is hard to imagine this particular idea occurring to anyone who wasn't acutely aware of the possibilities of Darwinian thinking. The easy cases are all cases that are readily interpreted as tasks of patrolling a social contract, or in other words, cheater detection. Cosmides and Tooby seem to have uncovered a fossil of our Nietzschean past. Framing the hypothesis is not yet proving it, of course, but one of the important virtues of their hypothesis is that it is eminently testable, and has so far stood up very well to a wide variety of attempts to refute it. Suppose it is not true. Would it show that we can reason only about the things Mother Nature wired us to reason about? Obviously not. It just shows why it is easier, more natural, for us to reason about some topics than others. We have devised cultural artifacts, systems of formal logic, statistics, decision theory, and so forth, taught in college courses, that expand our reasoning powers manyfold. Even the experts often neglect these specialized techniques, however, and fall back on good old seat-of-the-pants reasoning, sometimes with embarrassing results, as the Wason test shows. Independently of any Darwinian hypotheses, we know that, except when people are particularly self-conscious about using these heavy-duty reasoning techniques, they tend to fall into cognitive illusions. Why are we susceptible to these illusions? The evolutionary psychologist says, for the same reason we are susceptible to optical illusions and other sensory illusions. We're built that way. Mother Nature designed us to solve a certain set of problems posed by the environments in which we evolved. And whenever a cut-rate solution emerged, a bargain that would solve the most pressing problems pretty well, even if it lacked generality, it tended to get installed. Cosmides and Tooby call these modules Darwinian algorithms. They are mechanisms, just like the two-bitser, only fancier. We obviously don't get by with just one such reasoning mechanism. Cosmides and Tooby have been gathering evidence for other special-purpose algorithms, useful in thinking about threats and other social exchanges, and other ubiquitous problem types. Hazards, rigid objects, and contagion. Instead of having a single, central, general-purpose reasoning machine, we have a collection of gadgets, all pretty good, or at least pretty good in the environments in which they evolved, and readily acceptable for new purposes today. Our minds are like Swiss Army knives, Cosmides says. Every now and then we discover curious gaps in our competence, strange lapses that give us clues about the particular history of R&D that explains the machinery that underlies the glittering facade of culture. This is surely the right way for psychologists to reverse engineer the human mind, always watching out for quirky phenomena. I consider Cosmides and Tooby to be doing some of the best work in Darwinian psychology today, which is why I chose them for my example. But I must temper my recommendation with some constructive criticism. The ferocity of the attacks they have encountered from the fans of Gould and Chomsky is breathtaking. And embattled as they are, they too tend to caricature the opposition, and are sometimes too hasty in dismissing skepticism about their arguments as flowing from nothing more presentable than the defensive territoriality of old-fashioned social scientists who still haven't got the word about evolution. This is often, but not always, the case. Even if they are right, and I am confident that they are, that such rationality as we human beings have is the product of the activities of a host of special-purpose gadgets designed by natural selection, it does not follow that this Swiss Army knife of ours cannot have been used, time and time again, to reinvent the wheel. It still has to be shown, in other words, that any particular adaptation is not a cultural product responding quite directly and rationally to quite recent conditions. They know this, and they carefully avoid the trap we have just discussed E.O. Wilson falling into. But in the heat of battle, they sometimes forget. Like Darwin overlooking the innocuous possibility of sudden extinctions because he was so intent on fleeing from catastrophism, Tooby and Cosmides and the other evolutionary psychologists tend to overlook the bland possibility of the independent rediscovery of forced moves. So intent are they on replacing the standard social science model with a properly Darwinian model of the mind. The standard social science model has among its precepts, whereas animals are rigidly controlled by their biology, human behavior is determined by culture, an autonomous system of symbols and values. Free from biological constraints, cultures can vary from one another arbitrarily and without limit. Learning is a general purpose process used in all domains of knowledge. Pinker, 1994, page 406. See also Tooby and Cosmides, 1992, pages 24 to 48. This, of course, is wrong, wrong, wrong. But compare it with my only slightly non-standard social science model. Whereas animals are rigidly controlled by their biology, human behavior is largely determined by culture, a largely autonomous system of symbols and values, growing from a biological base, but growing indefinitely away from it. Able to overpower or escape biological constraints in most regards, cultures can vary from one another enough so that important portions of the variance are thereby explained. Learning is not a general purpose process, but human beings have so many special purpose gadgets and learn to harness them with such versatility that learning often can be treated as if it were an entirely medium-neutral and content-neutral gift of non-stupidity. This is the model I have argued for in this audiobook. It is no defense of skyhooks. It simply acknowledges that we now have cranes of more general power than the cranes of any other species. There is plenty of good work in sociobiology and evolutionary psychology, and there is plenty of bad work, as in any field. Is any of it evil? Some of it is at least dismayingly heedless of the misuses to which it might be put by ideologues of one persuasion or another. But here again, the escalation of charges typically produces more heat than light. One instance can stand in for a survey of the whole sorry field of battle. Do ducks rape? Sociobiologists have uncovered a common pattern in which males in some species, such as ducks, violently mate with obviously unwilling females. They have called it rape. And this terminology has been decried by critics, most vigorously by the feminist biologist Anne Fausto Sterling, 1985. She has a point. I said we wouldn't call the sibling side that many species engage in murder, since they know not what they do. They kill, but do not murder each other. It is impossible for one bird to murder another bird. Murder is reserved for the intentional, deliberate, wrongful killing of one human being by another. You can kill a bear, but not murder it. And if it kills you, that isn't murder either. Now, can one duck rape another? Fausto Sterling and other feminists say no. This is to misapply a term that also properly applies only to human misdeeds. If there were a common term in English that stood to rape as kill or homicide or manslaughter stood to murder, then the use by sociobiologists of the term rape for non-human forced copulation, instead of using the less loaded term, would be truly outrageous. But there isn't any such term. So is the use of the short, vivid term rape in place of forced copulation or other such term a serious sin? It is, at least, insensitive. But do the critics complain about the other terms drawn from human life in common use by sociobiologists? There is sexual cannibalism in spiders. The females wait till the males have finished impregnating them and then kill and eat them. There are lesbian gulls, female couples that stay paired over several seasons, defending territory, building a nest, sharing the task of sitting on the eggs. There are homosexual worms and bird cuckolds. At least one critic, Jane Lancaster, 1975, does in fact object to the word harem, used to refer to the group of females guarded and mated by a single male, such as an elephant seal. She recommends the term one male group, since these females are virtually self-sufficient, except for fertilization. Fausto Sterling, 1985, page 181N. It seems to me that deliberate human cannibalism is much, much more terrible than anything one spider could do to another, but I, for one, don't object if an arachnologist wants to use the term. For that matter, what about the benign terms? G. Williams, 1988. Do the critics also object to courtship ritual and alarm call? Or the use of the term mother to refer to a female but non-human parent? Fausto Sterling does note that the sociobiologists she criticizes for using the term rape were careful to assert that human rape was different from rape in other species. She quotes, page 193, from Shields and Shields, 1983. Ultimately, men may rape because it increases their biological fitness, and thus rape may serve, at least in part, a reproductive function. But in an immediate, proximate sense, it is as likely that they rape because they are angry or hostile, as the feminists suggest. This passage is not the ringing denunciation of rape that Fausto Sterling requires, something that one might think would go without saying in the context of a scientific article, but it does firmly disassociate human rape from any biological justification. That makes Fausto Sterling's further charge outrageous. She places responsibility on these sociobiologists for various claims made by defense lawyers in rape cases who have got their clients off relatively easily by noting their unbearable physical urges or by describing a client's act. As rapes go, a relatively mild rape. What do these claims have to do with sociobiology in general, or the articles she discusses in particular? She offers no reason at all to believe these lawyers cited the sociobiologists as supporting authorities, or so much as knew of their existence. With equal justice, she could blame the tribe of Shakespeare scholars for such miscarriages of justice, supposing that such they were, for these scholars have no doubt been insufficiently condemnatory in their writings over the years about Shakespeare's sometimes tolerant portrayal of rape in his plays. This is surely not the way to foster enlightened consideration of the issues. Tempers run high, and the issues are deadly serious, which is all the more reason for scientists and philosophers to be careful not to abuse either the truth or each other in the name of a worthy cause. What, then, would be a more positive approach to a naturalized ethics look like? I have a few preliminary suggestions to offer in the next chapter. Chapter 16. As Darwinian thinking gets closer and closer to home, where we live, tempers run higher, and the rhetoric tends to swamp the analysis. But sociobiologists, beginning with Hobbes and continuing through Nietzsche to the present day, have seen that only an evolutionary analysis of the origins and transformations of ethical norms could ever properly make sense of them. Greedy reductionists have taken their usual first stumbling steps into this new territory and been duly chastened by the defenders of complexity. We can learn from these errors without turning our backs on them. Chapter 17. What are the implications for ethics of the fact that we are finite, time-pressured, heuristic searchers for ethical truths? An examination of the persistent pendulum swing between utilitarian and Kantian ethics suggests some principles for redesigning ethics along more realistic Darwinian lines. Chapter 17. Redesigning Morality. 1. Can ethics be naturalized? Thus at last man comes to feel, through acquired and perhaps inherited habit, that it is best for him to obey his more persistent impulses. The imperious word ought seems merely to imply the consciousness of the existence of a rule of conduct, however it may have originated. Charles Darwin, Descent of Man, 2nd edition, 1874, page 486. Human culture, religion in particular, is a repository of ethical precepts, ranging from the Golden Rule, the Ten Commandments, and the Greeks' Know Thyself, to all manner of specific commands and prohibitions, taboos and rituals. Philosophers since Plato have attempted to organize these imperatives into a single, rationally defensible, and universal system of ethics, so far without achieving anything approaching consensus. Mathematics and physics are the same for everyone everywhere, but ethics has not yet settled into a similar reflective equilibrium. Why not? Is the goal illusory? Is morality just a matter of subjective taste and political power? Are there no discoverable and confirmable ethical truths, no forced moves or good tricks? Great edifices of ethical theory have been constructed, criticized and defended, revised and extended by the best methods of rational inquiry. And among these artifacts of human reasoning are some of the most magnificent creations of culture. But they do not yet command the untroubled assent of all those who have studied them carefully. Perhaps we can get some clues about the status and prospects for ethical theory by reflecting on what we have seen to be the limitations of the great design process that has ethicists among its products to date. What follows, we may ask, from the fact that ethical decision-making, like all actual processes of exploration in design space, must be to some degree myopic and time-pressured. Shortly after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, another eminent Victorian, John Stuart Mill, published his attempt at a universal ethical theory, Utilitarianism, 1861. Darwin read it with interest and responded to the celebrated work in his Descent of Man, 1871. Darwin was puzzled by Mill's stand on whether the moral sentiment was innate or acquired, and sought the help of his son William, who advised his father that Mill was rather in a muddle on the whole subject. R. Richards, 1987, page 209N. But aside from a few such points of disharmony, Darwin and Mill were correctly seen as united in their naturalism, and duly excoriated together by the defenders of skyhooks, most notably St. George Mivart, who declared, "Men have a consciousness of an absolute and immutable rule legitimately claiming obedience with an authority necessarily supreme and absolute." In other words, intellectual judgments are formed which imply the existence of an ethical ideal in the judging mind. Mivart, 1871, page 79. To such bluster, there is probably no better response than Darwin's, quoted at the head of this section. But there were more measured criticisms as well, and one of the more frequent stuck in the craw of Mill. Defenders of utility often find themselves called upon to rely to such objections as this, that there is not time, previous to action, for calculating and weighing the effects of any line of conduct on the general happiness. His reaction was quite fierce. Men really ought to leave off talking a kind of nonsense on this subject, which they would neither talk nor listen to on other matters of practical concernment. Nobody argues that the art of navigation is not founded on astronomy because sailors cannot wait to calculate the nautical almanac. Being rational creatures, they go to sea with it ready calculated. And all rational creatures go out upon the sea of life with their minds made up on the common questions of right and wrong, as well as on many of the far more difficult questions of wise and foolish. And this, as long as foresight is a human quality, it is to be presumed they will continue to do. Mill, 1861, page 31. This haughty retort has found favor with many, perhaps most, ethical theorists, but in fact it papers over a crack that has been gradually widening under an onslaught of critical attention. The objectors were under the curious misapprehension that a system of ethical thinking was supposed to work, and noted that Mill's system was highly impractical at best. This was no objection, Mill insisted. Utilitarianism is supposed to be practical, but not that practical. Its true role is as a background justifier of the foreground habits of thought of real moral reasoners. This background role for ethical theory, and not only utilitarians have sought it, has proven, however, to be ill-defined and unstable. Just how practical is a system of ethical thinking supposed to be? What is an ethical theory for? Tacit differences of opinion about this issue, and even a measure of false consciousness among the protagonists, have added to the inconclusiveness of the subsequent debate. For the most part, philosophers have been content to ignore the practical problems of real-time decision-making, regarding the brute fact that we are all finite and forgetful, and have to rush to judgment, as a real but irrelevant element of friction in the machinery whose blueprint they are describing. It is as if there might be two disciplines, Ethics proper, which undertakes the task of calculating the principles, determining what the ideal agent ought to do under all circumstances, and then the less interesting, merely practical discipline of moral first aid, or what to do until the doctor of philosophy arrives, which tells, in rough and ready terms, how to make online decisions under time pressure. In practice, philosophers acknowledge we overlook important considerations, considerations that we really shouldn't overlook, and we bias our thinking in 100 idiosyncratic and morally indefensible ways. But in principle, what we ought to do is what the ideal theory, one ideal theory or another, says we ought to do. Philosophers have then concentrated, not unwisely, on spelling out what that ideal theory is, the theoretical fruits of deliberate oversimplification through idealization are not to be denied. In philosophy or in any scientific discipline, reality in all its messy particularity is too complicated to theorize about, taken straight. The issue is, rather, since every idealization is a strategic choice, which idealizations might really shed some light on the nature of morality, and which will just land us with diverting fairy tales. It is easy to forget just how impractical ethical theories actually are. But we can make the truth vivid by reflecting on what is implicit in Mill's use of a metaphor drawn from the technology of his own day. The Nautical Almanac is an ephemeris of sorts, a book of tables, calculated and published annually, from which one can easily and swiftly derive the exact position in the skies of the sun, the moon, the planets, and the major stars for each second of the forthcoming year. The precision and certainty of this annual generator of expectations was, and still is, an inspiring instance of the powers of human foresight, properly disciplined by a scientific system and directed upon a sufficiently orderly topic. Armed with the fruits of such a system of thought, the rational sailor can indeed venture forth confident of his ability to make properly informed real-time decisions about navigation. The practical methods devised by the astronomers actually work. Do the utilitarians have a similar product to offer to the general public? Mill seems at first to be saying so. Today, we are inured to the inflated claims made on behalf of dozens of high-tech systems, of cost-benefit analysis, computer-based expert systems, etc. And from today's perspective, we might suppose Mill to be engaging in an inspired bit of advertising, suggesting that utilitarianism can provide the moral agent with a foolproof decision-making aid. We have done the difficult calculations for you. All you need do is just fill in the blanks in the simple formula provided. Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, certainly aspired to just such a philosophic calculus, complete with mnemonic jingles, just like the systems of practical celestial navigation that every sea captain memorized. Intense, long, certain, speedy, fruitful, pure. Such marks in pleasures and in pains endure. Such pleasures seek if private be thy end. If it be public, wide let them extend. Bentham, 1789, Chapter 4. Bentham was a cheerfully greedy reductionist, the B.F. Skinner of his day, you might say. And this myth of practicality has been part of the rhetoric of utilitarianism from the beginning. But in Mill, we see already the beginning of the retreat up the ivory tower to ideality, to what is calculable in principle, but not in practice. Mill's idea, for instance, was that the best of the homilies and rules of thumb of everyday morality, the formula people actually considered in the hectic course of their deliberations, had received, or would receive in principle, official endorsement from the full, laborious, systematic, utilitarian method. The faith placed in these formula by the average rational agent, based as it was on many lifetimes of experience accumulated in cultural memory, could be justified in principle by being formally derived from the theory. But no such derivation has ever been achieved. The reason is not hard to see. It is unlikely in the extreme that there could be a feasible algorithm for the sort of global cost-benefit analysis that utilitarianism or any other consequentialist theory requires. Why? Because of what we might call the Three Mile Island effect. Was the meltdown at the nuclear plant at Three Mile Island a good thing to have happened, or a bad thing? If, in planning some course of action, you encountered the meltdown as a sequel of probability P, what should you assign to it as a weight? Is it a negative outcome that you should strive to avoid, or a positive outcome to be carefully fostered? We can't yet say, and it is not clear that any particular long run would give us the answer. Notice that this is not a problem of insufficiently precise measurement. We can't even determine the sign, positive or negative, of the value to assign to the outcome. Compare the problem facing us here with the problems confronting the designers of computer chess programs. One might suppose that the way to respond to the problem of real-time pressure for ethical decision-making techniques is the way one responds to time pressure in chess, heuristic search-pruning techniques. But there is no checkmate in life, no point at which we get a definitive result, positive or negative, from which we can calculate, by retrograde analysis, the actual values of the alternatives that lay along the path taken. How deep should one look before settling on a weight for a position? In chess, what looks positive from ply 5 may look disastrous from ply 7. There are ways of tuning one's heuristic search procedures to minimize, but not definitively, the problem of misevaluating anticipated moves. Is the anticipated capture a strongly positive future to be aimed at, or the beginning of a brilliant sacrifice for your opponent? A principle of quiescence will help to resolve that issue. Always look a few moves beyond any flurry of exchanges to see what the board looks like when it quiets down. But in real life, there is no counterpart principle that deserves reliance. Three Mile Island has been followed by more than a decade of consolidation and quiescence. It happened in 1980. But we still have no idea whether it is to be counted among the good things that have happened or the bad, all things considered. The suspicion that there is no stable and persuasive resolution to such impasses has long lain beneath the troubled surface of criticism to consequentialism, which looks to many skeptics like a thinly veiled version of the vacuous stock market advice, buy low and sell high. A great idea in principle, but systematically useless as advice to follow. So not only have utilitarians never made an actual practice of determining their specific moral choices by calculating the expected utilities of all the alternatives, there not being time, as our original objector noted, but they have never achieved stable offline derivations of partial results, landmarks and direction posts, as Mill puts it, to be exploited on the fly by those who must cope with matters of practical concernment. What then of the utilitarians' chief rivals, the various sorts of Kantians? Their rhetoric has likewise paid tribute to practicality, largely via their indictments of the impracticality of the utilitarians. What, though, do the Kantians put in the place of the unworkable consequentialist calculations? Maxim following, often derided as rule worship of one sort or another, such as that invoked in one of Kant's 1785 formulations of the categorical imperative. Act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law, Kantian decision-making typically reveals rather different idealizations, departures from reality in other directions, doing all the work. For instance, unless some deus ex machina is standing by, a handy master of ceremonies to whisper suggestions in your ear, it is far from clear just how you are supposed to figure out how to limit the scope of the maxims of your contemplated actions before putting them to the litmus test of the categorical imperative. There seems to be an inexhaustible supply of candidate maxims. Certainly the quaint Benthamite hope of a fill-in-the-blanks decision procedure for ethical problems is as foreign to the spirit of modern Kantians as it is to sophisticated utilitarians. All philosophers can agree, it seems, that real moral thinking takes insight and imagination, and is not to be achieved by any mindless application of formulae. As Mill himself puts it, 1871, page 31, still in high dudgeon, "There is no difficulty in proving any ethical standard whatever to work ill if we suppose universal idiocy conjoined with it." This bit of rhetoric is somewhat at war with his earlier analogy, however, since one of the legitimate claims of the systems of practical navigation was that just about any idiot could master them. I do not at all intend this to be a shocking indictment, just a reminder of something quite obvious. No remotely compelling system of ethics has ever been made computationally tractable, even indirectly, for real-world moral problems. So even though there has been no dearth of utilitarian and Kantian and contractarian, etc., arguments in favor of particular policies, institutions, practices, and acts, these have all been heavily hedged with ceteris paribus clauses and plausibility claims about their idealizing assumptions. These hedges are designed to overcome the combinatorial explosion of calculation that threatens if one actually attempts, as theory says one must, to consider all things. And as arguments, not derivations, they have all been controversial, which is not to say that none of them could be sound in the last analysis. To get a better sense of the difficulties that contribute to actual moral reasoning, let us give ourselves a smallish moral problem and see what we do with it. Though a few of its details are exotic, the problem I am setting exemplifies a familiar structure. 2. Judging the competition. Your philosophy department has been chosen to administer a munificent bequest, a 12-year fellowship to be awarded in open competition to the most promising graduate student in philosophy in the country. You duly announce the award and its conditions in the Journal of Philosophy, and then, to your dismay, you receive by the deadline 250,000 legal entries, complete with lengthy dossiers, samples of written work, and testimonials. A quick calculation convinces you that living up to your obligation to evaluate all the material of all the candidates by the deadline for announcing the award would not only prevent the department from performing its primary teaching mission, but, given the costs of administration and hiring additional qualified evaluators, bankrupt the award fund itself, so that all the labor of evaluation would be wasted. No one would gain. What to do? If only you had anticipated the demand, you could have imposed tighter eligibility conditions. But it is too late for that. Every one of the 250,000 candidates has, we will suppose, a right to equal consideration. And in agreeing to administer the competition, you have undertaken the obligation to select the best candidate. I don't mean to beg any questions with this formulation in terms of rights and obligations. If it makes a difference to you, recast the setting of the problem in terms of the overall disutility of violating the conditions set forth in your announcement of the competition. My point is that you would find yourself in a bind, whatever your ethical persuasion. Before listening further, please spend a little time, as much as you think it takes, to plot your own solution to the problem. No fantasies about technological fixes, please. When I have put this problem to colleagues and students, I find that, after a brief exploratory period, they tend to home in on one version or another of a mixed strategy, such as 1. Choose a small number of easily checked and not entirely unsymptomatic criteria of excellence, such as grade point average, number of philosophy courses completed, weight of the dossier, eliminating the too light and the too heavy, and use this to make a first cut. 2. Conduct a lottery with the remaining candidates, cutting the pool down randomly to some manageably small number of finalists, say 50 or 100. 3. Whose dossiers will be carefully screened by a committee, which will then vote on the winner. There is no doubt that this procedure is very unlikely to find the best candidate. Odds are, in fact, that more than a few of the losers, if given a day in court, could convince a jury that they were obviously superior to the elected winner. But, you might want to retort, that's just tough. You did the best you could. It is quite possible, of course, that you would lose the lawsuit, but you might still feel, rightly, that you could have arrived at no better decisions at the time. My example is meant to illustrate, enlarged, and in slow motion, the ubiquitous features of real-time decision-making. First, there is the simple physical impossibility of considering all things in the allotted time. Note that all things doesn't have to mean everything or even everybody in the world, but just everything in 250,000 readily available dossiers. You have all the information you need at your fingertips. There need be no talk of conducting further investigations. Second, there is the ruthless and peremptory use of some distinctly second-rate cut rules. No one thinks grade point average is a remotely foolproof indicator of promise, though it is probably somewhat superior to weight of dossier, and clearly superior to number of letters in surname. There is something of a trade-off between ease of application and reliability, and if no one can quickly think of any easily applied criteria that one can have some faith in, it would be better to eliminate step one and proceed straight to the lottery for all candidates. Third, the lottery illustrates a partial abdication of control, giving up on a part of the task and letting something else, nature or chance, take over for a while, yet still assuming responsibility for the result. That is the scary part. Fourth,